Chapter 9, The Evolution of Race. In looking into the issue of race, much of my attention had dealt with the impact of heredity on intelligence. But evidence accumulated showing the powerful role of genetics in human behavior in many areas beyond IQ. The popular version of psychology packaged by the liberal media continues to insist that upbringing or conditioning shapes all human personality traits. It is an article of faith that criminal behavior comes from a bad environment or a dysfunctional family. It seems that every societal problem is blamed on poverty, poor education, or bad parenting. Some even blame high robbery and murder rates on the availability of guns. Few Americans know that numerous studies show that a person's disposition toward criminality can be inherited. One extensive study analyzed the data compiled from 14,427 adoptions in Denmark from 1924 to 1947. Over two decades of data revealed that the biological children of criminals, even when adopted by non-criminal parents at an early age, had much higher rates of criminality than the adopted children whose genetic parents were law-abiding. Over 50 twin and adoption studies have found that about 50% of the variance in antisocial behavior is heritable. Every major adoption study of criminality in the 20th century shows similar results. Studies of identical and fraternal twins raised together show that identical twins are more than twice alike in their criminal behavior as are fraternal twins. In a number of scientific research studies done in the 1990s, it's been shown that through MRIs and electrical scans that there are actually differences in the functioning of the average brains of criminals as compared to the law-abiding. The following excerpt is from the Journal of Biological Psychiatry in 1997 about a study of the brains of 41 murderers who pled not guilty by reason of insanity and 41 age and sex matched non-criminals. It shows that criminal brains revealed differences in structure between them and non-criminal groups. Quote, "These preliminary findings provide initial indications of a network of abnormal cortical and subcortical brain processes that may predispose to violence in murderers found not guilty by reason of insanity." Numerous studies show that extroversion, introversion, altruism, selfishness, self-esteem, dishonesty, truthfulness, and many other character traits have strong hereditary influence. I had always believed that those kinds of personality traits were a product of environment rather than genes, but once I read the scientific journals, I found the evidence very persuasive. At the same time that I was learning these things as a teenager, William Hamilton and others launched a whole new scientific discipline called sociobiology. It advanced the idea that much social behavior, both of individuals and groups, is dramatically affected by heredity. In the three decades since I first looked into the issue in the mid-1960s, what's called behavioral genetics, sociobiology, and recently evolutionary psychology have become respected academic disciplines. From the period of the beginning of the Second World War to the 1960s, the media associated genetic and racial understanding with the image of German National Socialism. While the media dubiously attempted to shape public opinion pertaining to these matters, the scientific world amassed data on the gene and its powerful social role. Important research findings were ignored by the mass media. However, as increasing evidence of the power of human genetics became known, the breakthroughs could no longer be kept from public knowledge. Genes were directly linked with certain kinds of diseases, such as cancers, mental conditions such as schizophrenia and depression, and of course, intelligence and behavior. Social problems such as alcoholism and homosexuality were shown to be influenced by genes, and there was a reaffirmation, at least in scientific circles, of a genetic influence on criminality. Discoveries were made of dramatic differences in the architecture of the male and the female brain. So many possibilities opened up for the understanding and improvement of the human condition through genetics that a number of governments joined together and eventually launching perhaps the most ambitious scientific investigation of all time. It was called the Human Genome Project, an attempt to identify all the genes affecting mankind. Studies on identical twins, which had begun in the 1920s, suddenly began to be pursued again by psychologists and geneticists. In the 1960s and 70s, the public was astounded to learn what many psychologists had known almost the entire century, that many identical twins separated from birth and living in entirely different environments and cultures had remarkably similar personality traits and habits. Amazing stories filled the press of identical twins who, although growing up thousands of miles from each other, they smoked the same brand of cigarettes, pursued identical occupations, and had almost identical personal habits. Also, a wealth of evidence was amassed comparing personality differences between identical and fraternal twins. Below is a chart showing results of just a few of the more recent studies of behavioral genetics showing the heritability of personality traits. This section is racial differences in personality. Just as all IQ studies show a marked difference in IQ between the white and black races, psychologists report dramatic personality differences as well. In high school, I had subscribed to a few racially conscious publications. They often referred to scientific studies on the race question. I had the habit of looking up the articles for myself in the journals and books that can be found in university libraries close to my home. Every month, I would go to Tulane or LSU and make Xerox copies from the articles that interested me. I have kept in the habit of reading them over the years and have found much more corroborating evidence since those early days, but there was a wealth of material available even then. I show now in my book in the text, and again I urge you to get the text and take a look at this and see the charts. I show a chart of the personality traits shown to have a significant genetic component. And the chart shows evidence from scientists Bouchard, McGue, and Rushton. And it displays a number of character traits that are strongly influenced by heredity. I want to explain the percentage or the percent in terms of the impact of heredity. Let's look at it this way. For instance, say you have a trait. If a trait is 100% caused by heredity, it would show up as a 1.0. And theoretically, if a trait had no impact of heredity, which is all environment, it would be represented as a 0. And if a trait was a perfect balance, half and half between heredity and environment, it would be represented by a 0.5. So here's a list of some values and the study of these people. Again, the documentation is available in my book. Agreeableness. This is from 2003. 0.54. So it's about half and half. Aggression, 0.42. Alienation, 0.50. Altruism and social responsibility, 0.44. Cautiousness, 0.40. Conscientiousness, 0.49. Emotional reactivity, 0.44. Extroversion, 0.51. Traditionalism, 0.42. Work values, 0.36. So here you have all these traits showing that there is a dramatic influence of both heredity and environment, that is not only environmentally produced. One interesting publication I read was the Psychological Bulletin. I found a couple of articles from the early 1960s that discussed how blacks tend to be more impulsive and unrestrained than whites. Dreger and Miller called some of the black personality traits estrangement and impulse-ridden fantasies. In later years, numerous articles detailed other black personality differences. An extreme liberal, Thomas Cockman, noted clear racial distinctions in personality between blacks and whites, and he expressed his preference for black characteristics. He argued that black males perceive being ignored as the highest insult and recommends that white women should react to black sexual aggression with sassy rejoinders just as black women do. He went so far as to suggest that the typical non-black behavior style of white women caused violent black male attacks. Cockman also noted that blacks have, quote, intense and spontaneous emotional behavior, unquote, and that black, quote, rhythmic way of walking, unquote, is a, quote, response from impulses coming from within, unquote. He characterized white debating techniques as, quote, low-key, dispassionate, impersonal, and non-challenging, cool, quiet, and without effect, quote, unquote, while he describes black approach to argument as, quote, animated, confrontational, heated, and loud, unquote. Blacks argue not simply the idea, but, quote, the person debating the idea. And that is directly from his data, and again, the citation is available in my book, Hardcore. After personally experiencing the black style of argument on many occasions, I had to agree with Cockman's evaluation. However, I dispute his notion that such primitive and emotional behavior enriches our culture. After I read Cockman, I noted and noticed that frequent news reports of black males who argue in precisely the way he described, heated, confrontational, and loud, leading them to impulsively use their Saturday night specials. Our public hospitals are full of the victims of such heated and unrestrained black styles of argument. Many studies showed the greater levels of impulsiveness, aggression, and emotionalism in blacks as compared to whites. A study that took place in Trinidad compared blacks and Caucasian immigrants from India. Walter Mischel conducted a study of children in Trinidad in which he gave white and black children the choice between a candy bar immediately or a larger one a week later. Blacks almost always chose the immediate gratification, while whites usually chose to wait for the bigger reward. The inability of the blacks to delay gratification was so great in comparison with whites that Mischel stated that measuring it seemed superfluous. Mischel also tried to compare the familial patterns of blacks who almost always had female-headed households as compared to East Indian households, but he could not find enough East Indian households with absent fathers to constitute a statistically meaningful study. Other books, such as The Unheavenly City Revisited by Edward Bainfield, noted that the inner city's inhabitants that include many blacks have less tendency to defer gratification and an extreme orientation to the present. Most of the men who noted these psychological differences between the races took for granted their cultural origins, but many new studies reveal that such tendencies have hereditary implications. One of the more interesting aspects of the study of criminal behavior I learned about was its links with testosterone. Research has long noted that males are about 10 times more often found guilty of violent crimes than are women. And high crime rates coincide with high levels of testosterone in adolescence. Criminal youths are also found to have high average levels of testosterone than non-criminals of the same age. Interestingly enough, young blacks are found at significantly higher levels of testosterone than do young whites. The black crime rate is about 300% higher than that of whites on a worldwide basis. Higher levels of testosterone could contribute to greater sexual aggression as well, contributing both to rape and assault of women as well as instability in relationships. It's also easy to see how it could damage the family. In my reading, I learned that in Africa, as well as in every New World black society, illegitimacy and promiscuity is far more common than in European societies. In the United States, for instance, the African-American illegitimacy rate is fast approaching 75% of all newborns. The chronic social problem of absent black fathers in America is found repeated on a worldwide scale. In a research paper on African marriage systems, Patricia Draper describes the parenting role of Negro fathers in Africa and the Americas. And I quote, "The psychological, social, and spatial distance of husbands' fathers, together with their freedom from direct economic responsibility, relieves them of most aspects of the parental role as Westerners understand the term." Unquote. I wanted to understand the reasons why the black differences existed. That meant a look into the evolutionary aspects of the formation of the major races. But before I did that, I had to answer a more pertinent question. Ashley Montague, real name Israel Ehrenberg, maintained in his books and articles that race is simply a cultural myth. In recent times, the view has been parroted frequently in the media. Is race real, or is it a socially contrived invention? Today, even since the writing of my book, this is a side note with the audio version, it's been called now, they've defined the term, and they call race simply a social construct. In other words, something that's not real, it's just a social construct. So this next section deals with the reality of race itself. Ashley Montague's book, Man's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race, had impressed me before I began my look into the other side of the scientific studies on race. The myth of race position is essentially that skin color, hair type, and other traits that influence racial classification are completely arbitrary traits of mankind and are as unimportant as different types of fingerprint designs. After almost 30 years of the media proclaiming, quote, the myth of race, race critic Jared Diamond refined the argument in the 1994 issue of the very popular Discover magazine. Diamond chose a few traits such as lactose intolerance and fingerprint patterns that vary geographically among human populations and suggested by those traits alone that Swedes could be put in the same racial category as the Ainu of Japan or the Hoxha of Africa. He asserted, therefore, that racial classification was nonsensical. Another media popular disclaimer of race was the Kavili Sforza who study, which in the preface of his this major work, The History and Geography of Human Genes, editorialized in the support of the arguments of Diamond and Montague. Interestingly, though, this same study, this Kavili Sforza World Gene Distribution Map and Study, showed the same geographic boundaries that reflect in traditional racial groupings. So although he didn't call it race, his gene differentiation map is almost exactly along the lines of traditional races, geographically. I realized back in the 1960s that the, quote, myth of race argument is perfectly analogous to saying that the dozens of different breeds of dogs is a myth because one can find some specific traits that exist in varying breeds. I thought about the question long and hard, and I asked myself, because some similar traits are found in different breeds of dogs, does that mean that there are no St. Bernards or Chihuahuas? If they're found in man, does that mean there's no such things as blacks or whites or Asians? If Ashley Montague were attacked by a dog, I think it might matter to him whether the dog was a Doberman Pinscher or a toy poodle. As the Doberman began to tear into his flesh, would Montague still insist that the differences among the breeds of canines don't exist? Even Montague could predict that a Doberman offers a great deal more potential danger than a toy poodle. If Diamond wants to be technical about it, many human traits and sets of traits can be found that exist in other mammals. In fact, humans share 98.5% of their genes with chimpanzees. If one follows Diamond's rationale, there is no difference between humans and chimpanzees because we can find sets of arbitrary selected genetic traits that we share. A number of scientists in recent times have brought up the fact that the DNA in blacks and whites differs by less than 1%, and therefore such a small difference could not mean much difference between races. Yet, with only a 1.5% difference in DNA between humans and chimpanzees, humans have brains that are about twice as large. Small differences in DNA can make big differences in biological structure. Only a very small number of genes set the structure of an organism. It is similar to the fact that only a small set of paper architectural plans make a tremendous difference in the way wood, steel, concrete, and glass construct a house, or for that matter, a skyscraper. Saying that the races are the same because similar genes make up the bulk of the physical structures of both blacks and whites is analogous to saying that because a shack is built of wood, steel, and glass, it is exactly the same as a skyscraper made of the same materials. The vast majority of the basic genes that make up the races not only shared by them, but also by all mammals and even other orders of life. What makes the important distinctions are the small percentages of genes that affect the structure and composition of those life forms. A race is more or less distinct, is a distinct combination of inherited physiological, morphological, and behavioral traits. J. Philip Rushton describes it in this way, and he certainly does it in a term that I could not say any better. Quote, "A race is what zoologists term a variety or subdivision of a species. Each race, a variety, is characterized by a more or less distinct combination of inherited morphological, behavioral, physiological traits. In flowers, insects, and non-human mammals, zoologists consistently and routinely study the process of racial differentiation. Formation of a new race takes place when, over several generations, individuals in one group reproduce more frequently among themselves than they do with individuals in other groups. This process is most apparent when the individuals live in diverse geographic areas and therefore evolve unique, recognizable adaptions, such as skin color, that are advantageous in their specific environments. But differentiation also occurs under less extreme circumstances. Zoologists and evolutionists refer to such differentiation in populations as races. Within the formal taxonomic nomenclature of biology, races are termed subspecies. Zoologists have identified two or more races, subspecies, in most mammalian species." Unquote. Differences between the major races of mankind include over 50 physiological and social variables. Other than the obvious differences in skin color and hair texture, they include brain size, cranial structure, dentition, intelligence, musculature, hormonal levels, sexual norms, temperament, longevity, and a wide range of personality traits. As Rushton says eloquently, quote, "If race were an arbitrary, socially constructed concept, devoid of all biological meaning, such consistent relationships would not exist," unquote. Science has long established different species and subspecies as a recognizable group having a common heredity. Take a look at what a Random House Webster's Dictionary has to say about the subject, species. And this is biological, the major subdivision of a genus or subgenus, regarded as the basic category of biological classification, composed of related individuals that resemble one another, are able to breed among themselves, but are not able to breed with members of another species. Race, a group of persons related by a common descent, hereditary population, so related, breed, genetics, a relatively homogeneous group of animals within a species developed and maintained by humans. You know, lineage, stock, strain. And they use an example, she comes from a fine breed of people. Offensive, half-breed. And by the way, that's interesting if you take a look at these words. Even though many scientists argue for the existence of many races of mankind, most accept the existence of at least three major divisions. Mongoloid, Caucasoid, and Negroid. Obvious differences in facial features, skeletal and cranial capacities and characteristics, skin color, and hair types make the three races easily distinguishable. Blood, semen, and molecular information can determine the race or even an estimate of the racial mixture in an individual. Scientific investigators can readily identify the race just from the skeletal parts of a badly decomposed human remains. And the race of criminal perpetrators can readily be identified by traces of hair, semen, skin, or blood. The O.J. Simpson case gave the world a lesson in genetic racial identification. So again, my comment here is in the audiobook. It's obviously not simply a social construct. It is biological in nature and in identification. Denying the reality of race is a good example of how egalitarians are grasping for straws. A mass of scientific evidence of traits and features that identify the genetically differentiated breeds of mankind exist, just as there are genetically differentiated breeds of dogs or cats, or as I found out years earlier in my garage, domestic and wild breeds of rats. One does not need molecular studies to know that race exists. All one must do is use his eyes and some common sense. Imagine, for example, that a hypothetical extraterrestrial being that had no prior knowledge of humanity and no prejudices about race suddenly landed on the Earth to study its higher orders of life. He would immediately classify mankind into different groups by the general observable differences that exist among them, just as he would the rest of the mammals and the other higher life forms. He would do it in the same way that we have genealogically classified the orders, species, and subspecies, races or breeds, of the animal kingdom by their physical characteristics, appearance, and genetic imprint. When the Times-Picayune, my local New Orleans newspaper down in Louisiana, ran its article, White/Black, The Myth of Race, my campaign lawyer, James McPherson, quipped that it might as well have been called Light Heavy, The Myth of Gravity. In school, I discovered that anti-race bias had become almost a religion with some people. They parroted back the silliest and most illogical concepts about race. For instance, someone would tell me that there are no such things as races because there are some individuals who may be racially mixed or who are not clearly of one race or another. And that argument is like saying that there's no day or night because for a few minutes every day at dusk it's hard to tell whether it's night or day. Even a high school teacher of mine maintained that there were no racial differences because some whites are darker than some blacks, and some blacks, such as some Indian Caucasians, and some blacks are smarter than some whites. Trying to negate group differences by citing individual exceptions is the poorest logic I could imagine. It is much like saying that because some grade school children are more knowledgeable than some college students, that there's no difference between the knowledge of the average college student and grade school students. I have heard people say that individual variation within a race is greater than the average difference between races, so therefore race is irrelevant. One could easily take that fallacious argument to its logical conclusion and point out that since some humans, unfortunately, have less intelligence than some dogs, therefore, there is no difference between humans and canines in intelligence. The racial egalitarians are just that silly. Ridiculous, really. But they are never confronted. And this is a side comment for the audiobook. They are never challenged by the media, and these questions are never raised when these pronouncements are being made. It's just like the fable of the emperor's new clothes. Nobody dares to stand up and tell the truth. Arguments erupted frequently at school with the teachers quite often. One teacher told me that there was no point to race because it's impossible to really know who is black and who is white. I simply pointed out to her that the government seems to have no trouble, and governments around the world, no trouble in distinguishing between blacks and whites for affirmative action programs and programs to specifically help certain non-white minorities, and for forced integration of education, and that she obviously believes that blacks and whites can be identified and therefore integrated. By far, the most popular saying among egalitarians is that blacks and whites differ only in skin color, only by color of skin. We've all heard this argument 1,000 times. In fact, they discuss racial differences as simply one entirely of skin color. If that were true, one would be quite stupid to believe in racial differences in intelligence, and that is the direct implication. But the idea that skin color is the only difference is patently absurd. Yet the media consistently repeats it like a mantra, like a holy incantation. We're all the same other than color of skin. Well, how is it then that every one of the top 16 semifinalists in the 1996 Olympics 100-meter sprint were black, when 100 times more whites participate in organized track and field in the world? If the black difference is just darker skin color, how could skin color make one run faster? There are genetic qualities in black people that make them, on average, more efficient sprinters, and that talent has an association with skin color. If there are differences that can make one group have faster runners, it stands to reason there can be differences that make other groups be faster thinkers. I've already argued in this volume that IQ is primarily inherited and that blacks and whites differ dramatically in IQ, even when blacks and whites come from similar socioeconomic backgrounds. I have shown that there is abundant evidence of difference in the size of the brains of Africans as opposed to Europeans or Asians. Does the fact that there are at least 40 times more whites per capita who have a genius level of intelligence have to do with the fact that they have lighter skin color than Negroes? Lighter skin color has no direct effect on the brain. Intelligence is obviously created by genetic differences other than color of skin, although there may be an association of skin color with brain size and structure as representative of racial heritage. So although lighter skin does not make one smart, it can be associated with other racial genetic features that can. Until recent times, American society completely segregated people with any visible degree of black blood, even those only 1/8 or 1/16 Negro. It is an odd coincidence that lighter-skinned and Caucasian-featured blacks have a tremendous overrepresentation among Negroes who have achieved prominence in academic and scientific disciplines. Or could it simply be that their lighter skin color and Caucasian facial features are somewhat indicative of their predominant white genetic component, making their intelligence closer to the white norms? As I've noted previously, in repeated intelligence testing of mulattoes and full-blooded blacks, even when environmental factors are controlled, mulattoes average somewhere between whites and blacks. Yes, whites, blacks, and yellows have obvious differences in skin color and hair texture, but also in skeletal and cranial structure, blood groups, and DNA fingerprinting. The latest DNA studies, in fact, indicate that ancestors of blacks and whites split at least as long ago as 110,000 years, many say 200,000 years, and that whites and Asians split about 40,000 years ago. Subspecies, which is the scientific term for race, has always denoted a geographic genetic differentiation of the species. Europeans, Asians, and Africans obviously developed on different continents under different environments. I came to the conclusion that race is certainly real and that racial differences are inherent and profound. I then wanted to better understand how racial differences originated and their possible impact on modern society. To do that, I had to look into evolutionary theory. The next section is the evolution of races. To understand the evolution of the races, I found it instructive to understand the genetic development of dogs. All dog breeds are members of the same species, Canis familiaris, just as all humans are members of the same species, Homo sapiens. We call the different varieties of dogs breeds, and we call the different varieties of humans races, although breed can describe human varieties. The only difference in the two terms is that breed usually denotes genetic selection by humans, while races denote genetic selection by the forces of geographic environment. Selective breeding from a single species created the spectacular variety of dog breeds over a relatively short period of time, perhaps only 5 or 6,000 years, maybe as long as 8,000, 9,000 years. Humans selected dogs for certain physical and personality traits, segregated them from other dogs, and created the vast differences in dog breeds we see today. Before the existence of the black and white races as we know them, mankind's remote ancestors fanned out around the globe. The populations encountered vastly different environments that selected for many characteristics, the most readily recognizable being the physical trait of skin color, and also, of course, of hair color and texture and eye color. Once I understood the realities of racial difference, I realized that by learning about the evolutionary forces that created the different races, we could understand then the character and conduct of the various races, our own included. Numerous anthropological theories speculate about the origin and age of modern mankind and its varied races. The two dominant theories are called the single origin hypothesis and the multi-regional hypothesis. The multi-regionalists argue that a parallel evolution of the races has been going on since the Homo erectus stage of our evolution. According to this theory, Homo erectus emerged in Africa and migrated around the rest of the world. In the different regions, shaped by differing environmental conditions, they separately crossed the threshold of Homo sapiens. Homo erectus independently evolved to form the Mongoloid race in Asia, the Caucasian race in Europe, and the Negroid race in Africa. Anthropological artifacts seem to support this theory in that specimens of Homo erectus have been found in East Asia with tooth characteristics similar to those of the modern race that inhabits those regions. But the DNA and other genetic evidence suggests a contrary hypothesis. Geneticists maintain that after mankind's ancestors reached an archaic Homo sapiens stage in Africa, they then evolved separately into two distinct genetic groups, the African and the non-African, about 120,000 years ago. Some say it's as early as 70 or 80,000. Some say it's 200,000. Later, a split developed in the genetic heritage in the races, a split developed between Europeans and Asians, and that occurred about 40,000 years ago. Now, the latest DNA research seems to support the theory that the separate races evolved after crossing the Homo sapiens level. But the issue is far from decided. Whether or not the different races crossed the Homo sapiens threshold separately, the white and black races have been divided for at least 110,000 years, and if the multi-regionalists are right, then many hundreds of thousands of years longer. So by even the single origin theory, Asians and whites being separated for only 40,000 years have far more similarities than exist between blacks and whites. While scientists argue a bit about the timing, there is no doubt that the major races have been in existence for quite a long time, many tens of thousands of years, far more than enough time for geography and climate to have created the profound differences that exist between the races. When I considered that the real differences between dogs have been created by selective breeding over only 5,000 years, or at the max 8,000 or 9,000 years, it made sense to suppose that varying environments could have easily created the differences we see in mankind. For example, 100,000 years is time enough for over 5,000 human generations. To cause a 15-point higher increase in the average IQ of a population, it would only have to be an increase on average by a tiny fraction of 1%, 0.003, each generation. That's an average of less than 1/100th of an IQ point per generation. 5,000 generations is at least twice the number of generations needed to make the vast differences we see in the dog breeds. The geographically separated populations of mankind facing dramatically different climatic challenges created what we recognize as the major races of mankind. And by the way, here in my text, I give a lot of sources, which I again recommend to you and to document these ideas and issues. The next section goes into the climate, the effect of climate on racial evolution. The black race, we know, developed in the relatively warm, more tropical regions of sub-Saharan Africa, while the European and Asian races had their origins in the colder, harsher regions of Europe and Asia. Obviously, the environment of the two regions was dramatically different, and is dramatically different. It explains the lighter skin of whites as a colder, wetter climate and less available sunlight of Europe made lighter skin more advantageous for the adoption of very much needed vitamin D, a critical vitamin in development and health. And by the way, my latest studies have shown, this is since the writing of my book, that vitamin D, scientists are learning every day the incredible impact of vitamin D on our development, on our health. It affects almost 2,000 genes. And so skin color would be a very strong reason for vitamin D absorption. And when in a very cloudy climate like Europe, again, lighter skin is a very big advantage. In the tropics, dark skin is important to protect the body from the damaging rays of the sun. Another example of climatic adaption can be seen in the development of the protective eye fold of the Asians. The epicanthic fold is likely an evolutionary response to the extremely cold and windy weather of Northeast Asia. Lighter skin color is just one of the many genetic adaptions for survival of both Europeans and modern northern Asians. The very harsh, cold climate also selected for certain psychological and behavioral traits that facilitated survival. A cold climate selects for mental fitness and behavior in the same way it favors lighter skin. My interest in the effects of evolution on the races was stirred by Professor Carlton Coon, who at the time of my inquiry was the president of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists, the premier physical anthropologist living in the world. I read all of his books I could find, including The Living Races of Man, Story of Man, Origin of the Races, and The Races of Europe. Later, I read his classics, The Hunting Peoples, and in 1982, Racial Adaptations. Coon wrote extensively in his books on the impact of the extremely cold climates on prehistoric mankind. Two other books that made a great impact on me were Man the Hunter and The Hunters of the Northern Ice. From my reading, I began to sketch a broad outline of life that existed in the Northern Hemisphere during prehistoric times. Much of the last 200,000 years, the Northern world has been in periods of advancing and retreating glacial ice ages. The Northern Hemisphere is currently in a lull between ice ages. Survival for prehistoric man in Europe was far more difficult, even in the lulls between the ice ages, than for man in the milder African climate. During most of the last 80,000 years, Europe endured temperatures much colder than today. Modern Europeans emerged about 35,000 years ago and met the crucible of the Worm Glaciation, 24,000 to 10,000 BC. Temperatures then in Europe among these ancestors of our people probably averaged about 18 degrees Fahrenheit, colder than the present. I traveled on a short trip with my father to Kansas City, and while there experienced a snowstorm on the road to Lawrence, Kansas, his boyhood home and birthplace. As I read about the trials of prehistoric Europeans, I thought about the sub-zero temperatures and the miles upon miles of nothing but snow and ice that I'd seen. With that picture in my mind, I thought about how difficult it must have been for prehistoric humans to survive such rigors. Yet the temperatures of the Worm Glaciation would have been far colder than that of that winter in Kansas. As the ancestors of modern man migrated further to the north, they needed a number of vital skills and behavioral qualities to survive. Unlike tropical Africa, the technology to create warm, well-made clothing and sturdy shelter became necessary for survival. The ability to make and control fire became an essential survival skill. Dealing with the deadly forces of winter demanded skills not required in the tropics. Scarcity of edible plants and small game, and even the fact that birds migrated south for the winter, posed unique problems, as early man relied on a great deal of eggs and young animals for food. These were scarce in the cold months. In Africa, numerous kinds of edible vegetation existed, as well as small rodents and insects and other varied and abundant food sources. By contrast, the ground in Europe was a frozen sea of snow and ice for many months each year, and even many trees had no leaves. In the mildest of months, the inhabitants had to prepare for the harsh periods by deferring gratification and putting aside stores of food and supplies. In such cold climates, hunting large game rather than gathering edibles became the chief source of food and supplies. Because hunting provided most resources, females and children became dependent on male provisioning, leading to a strong bond between men and their immediate family. In both Europe and East Asia, men had to provide for their mates and their children if they were to survive. The difference is, of course, that in a gathering society, a single mother with children could provide the sustenance for her children without necessary male intervention and support. These things are spoken about in the next section of my book called Family Patterns of Europeans and Africans. In the more tropical climate of Africa, survival depended mostly on gathering rather than hunting. The lush vegetation and abundant small animal life provided a far greater food resource than in the northern climes. The African mother could feed herself and her children with little help from the father. On a pretty day, there was no necessity for the inhabitants of the tropics to control an impulse to lie upon a bed of leaves with a mate and satisfy sexual desires. But in the cold north, such an indulgence could affect survival in the winter months ahead. In the north, those who survived were more likely the ones who had the self-control to defer sexual or other forms of immediate gratification. On those pretty, warm days, they had to use that precious time and good weather to prepare for the extremely difficult winter days ahead. When the inevitable months of bad weather came, often they had to ration their food rather than completely satisfy their hunger. In Europe, the prehistoric economy found dependence on several primary animals. Probably the most important were the mastodon and the various breeds of deer and reindeer. Now extinct, the mastodon was the largest animal ever to walk the earth contemporaneous to man. A great hairy beast adapted to the cold temperatures of Europe and northern Asia. It stood about twice the size of the great African elephant, and had huge tusks and was easily strong enough to lift weight equivalent to a small automobile. To hunt such creatures demanded technologically effective weapons, as well as effective teamwork and advanced planning. Much of the prehistoric economy of Europe found its base in products harvested from the mastodon: meat and fat, thick skins for clothing, shoes, shelter, bone and sinew for weapons and tools, oil for their lamps, organ juice for thread and containers. The mastodon provided all these products and more. Obviously, it was hunted exclusively by males, and the same was true for deer and other game. With food supplies coming mostly from hunting rather than gathering, females and children were very dependent on male provisioning. At the same time, males depended on females for much of the work involved in preparing and processing the products of their kill, as well as the gathering needs of the clan, work which could be done while caring for children. If the male would randomly have sexual relations with females and then abandon them and his children, they had a greatly lessened chance of survival. Dr. J. Philip Rushton has done much work on these concepts in his groundbreaking paper, Differential K-Theory, The Sociobiology of Individual and Group Differences. You can see the citation and the information on it in my text, in my published text. Even when surviving, relatives shared some of the hunt with fatherless families in times of scarce food resources. They were likely to be the last fed. If the male had multiple mates and many children, even if he tried to take care of all of them, he could have difficulty providing for them. In Africa, because women generally supported themselves and their children, it was possible for them to support and raise their children without male support. Male bonding and support was not nearly as important to survival. In fact, male bonding, empathy, and time spent with the wife and children only lessened the male's opportunities to mate with more females. It was an environment and social system that greatly rewarded male sexual aggressiveness and infidelity. Evolutionary success for the African male found reward in his immediate gratifying his own sexual desires with as many females as possible. It favored male genes, leading to strong sexual drive, aggression, and genetic advantages in fighting that comes from intense male competition for women. Biologists call the strategy of having few children combined with high parental investment a K strategy, and that of having more children, which is naturally accompanied by less paternal investment, or less investment by the father, is called an R strategy. The tropical climate of Africa tended to support an R strategy among males and selected for males who employed that strategy. Because of female provisioning, an effective reproductive strategy for males was to father as many children as possible, since such conduct would give the most assurance that his genes would survive. In the harsh and resource-scarce environment of the cold climes, if a male were to father many children by many women, he would not likely be able to provision them. The result could well be the loss of all of them. However, males having a single family and fewer children could provide greater parental sustenance and care, enabling survival of a much higher percentage. The European environment thus encouraged a K reproductive strategy. In any society where males attempt to mate aggressively with as many females as possible, there is a great potential for violence. Efforts to mate with other males' mates would encounter risk of retaliation. Any biological group in which males frequently fight for females favors genes in males that lead to combative success. Hand-to-hand fighting is very anaerobic and usually only takes a few moments to determine a winner. It favors those who have muscles favored for quick bursts of speed rather than raw, sustained strength. A fighter with longer arms than his foe has a distinct advantage, making it easier to strike his enemy while avoiding his enemy's blows. A thicker cranium allows him to withstand blows to the head, which would otherwise render him insensible and vulnerable. A flat nose with wider nostrils allows greater airflow needed for quick exertion and is harder to break than the longer nose of Europeans needed to warm the cold air, as well as filter out viruses and bacteria. In prehistoric Europe, fighting could occur for many reasons, including pursuit of females and territorial conflicts, but the pattern of male provisioning of their mates and children certainly encouraged restraint. Although the European or Asian might sexually desire a female belonging to someone else, he had more reason to control his emotions and sexual urges, for if he was killed or seriously injured in a fight, his children could likely die as well. Until very recent times, most marriages were arranged by parents, so reason would suggest that they would attempt to select males for their daughters who are more inclined to fidelity. Many studies show that even in the modern world, women are far more selective and reticent than men in regard to mating. Among European and Asian women, this is especially true. Just as there is a striking difference between males and females, there's also a difference between European and African women. In prehistoric Europe, choosing the right mate was critical to the female's survival, for if her mate did not provision her, she and her children would face much greater hardship and possible death. In Africa, although there could be advantages for a woman if the male helped provide for her, it was not nearly as important to her survival. Surveys of blacks worldwide show that black males and females begin sexual relations earlier, have more sexual partners, more frequent sexual relations, more absent fathers, more polygamy, higher testosterone levels in males, more prominent secondary sexual characteristics, and much higher rates of sexually transmitted diseases. For instance, even in the United States, African Americans are 50 times more likely to have syphilis. And by the way, these quotations and facts on syphilis, you can see the citations in my book, in the text. You can look it up. It's footnote number 195. And in some areas, an incredible 100 times greater likelihood of gonorrhea. Blacks are 14 times more likely to have AIDS than non-Hispanic whites. And this is in the United States. I don't think there is any question that the epidemic in this country is becoming increasingly an epidemic of color. This is concerning AIDS, and that was said by Surgeon General David Satcher. Next section, physical manifestations. In colder climes, strength and endurance became the deciding physical factors for survival rather than speed. Men had to be strong enough to build complex and heavy structures of wood or stone, or sometimes even of ice. It made more evolutionary sense for the European to have a bit more insulating body fat and a larger body cavity, which protected the vital organs from cold, than Africans. As such features protect the body from times of intense cold. Africans have a lower percentage of body fat, arms and legs proportionately larger to body size. They have smaller body cavities and smaller heads, making them more physically efficient in running, jumping, and fighting. It's like imagining a mannequin that had a huge center like an egg, or a mannequin that was simply arms and legs. You can imagine the difference in speed, jumping, and running in terms of their physical abilities. In the modern world, and that's a side note, not in my text. In the modern world, black domination of boxing illustrates the physical differences created by the differing evolution of races. Soon after blacks were permitted to participate freely in the organized sport, they quickly asserted their superiority in it. Black athletes have muscle types that can provide quick bursts of speed, while whites tend to dominate sports that require maximum strength and endurance. Weightlifting, for example, is overwhelmingly dominated by Europeans and Asians. When I was looking into the evolutionary questions, one of the most heavily promoted sporting events in history was the Muhammad Ali Chuck Wepner Boxing World Championship fight. I remember the statistical differences to this day. In fact, a chart in the Times-Picayune showed a picture of the two fighters and gave the statistical differences of the two fighters. Wepner stood at 6 foot 6 inches in height. But interestingly, Ali, who stood 3 inches shorter, had a reach that was 6 inches longer. Wepner, however, was much stronger and could lift dramatically heavier weights than Ali. It became obvious in the fight that although Wepner had a tremendously powerful blow, Ali's speed allowed him to simply strike, bob, weave, and dance around a slower European-American opponent. Despite Ali's evolutionary advantage, in a courageous effort, Wepner lasted 15 rounds with Ali and inspired the Rocky movie series based on his character. I was probably the only one in the neighborhood who thought about the evolutionary racial differences between Ali and Wepner as the replay of the fight came on television. Next section is the roots of higher intelligence. In an extremely cold and inhospitable natural environment, higher human intelligence is dramatically favored. Europe demanded a higher technology for survival. If a society depends almost wholly on hunting, development of advanced weapons, traps, and sophisticated strategies can be critically important when there is scarce game. Effective hunting, fishing, and trapping in such an environment can demand well-developed cognitive skills. The invention and rigging of ingenious traps can demand high intelligence. The skills and the tools necessary to make a fire, no easy task in a cold and wet environment. can mean the difference between life and death. If a heavy shelter constructed to keep out winter collapses on the occupants because of poor design, they could well die. In equatorial Africa, if the leaves or straw huts blow away in a rainstorm, the occupants can easily build another one tomorrow. If a native gets lost in the rainforest of Africa, he can live on the fauna and flora while he finds his way back, while if the European, ancient European, gets lost in winter, he could very well freeze to death. A number of writers on European prehistory believe that navigating on long winter hunts with nondescript landscapes favored survival of Europeans and East Asians with a high level of spatial reasoning. Tracking the movements of reindeer and other Arctic herds from great distances demanded the intelligence to weigh past information and develop strategies to anticipate the herd movement. Parents and prospective brides naturally tried to choose potential mates who they thought would be faithful to the wife and children. Even the female intelligence needed to detect male deception became an important genetic advantage. It was important for a female and her parents to determine if a prospective male had other families on the side. If a male had other mates and children, he could well have to choose whom to provide with the dwindling stores when the shortages of winter approached. On the male side, it was evolutionarily important for him to figure out if his mate was cheating, and thus avoid provisioning a wife and children who were not passing on his genes. An important aspect of intelligence is the ability to think abstractly. To conceive winter on a warm spring or summer day is an abstract thought, as is the very concept of the future. In harsh climates, one must be able to conceive of tomorrow, and even more importantly, the more distant future, such as next winter. In tropical zones, life is much more immediate. Without the prospect of a harsh winter, there was little need to plan for the future. If one lives only in the immediate, in the moment, one is less likely to control or restrain impulsive behavior and less likely to delay gratification. In the long, cold hunts of the North, the hunter often had to be quiet and restrained for long periods of time. And other than occasional hunts for herds or mastodons, he was often likely to be alone for long periods of time. This would tend to favor restraint and introversion rather than talkativeness and extroversion. And we can see this evolutionary model as represented in the strong, silent prototype of the classic European. On a popular level, we can find it in our attraction to the stoic heroes of our Western movies, as is represented by men like Gary Cooper or John Wayne, or even the classic Clint Eastwood. That behavioral characteristic can be readily contrasted to the jive talk or the trash talk of the stereotypical black athlete, or the sexual rap by black males ever on the prowl in the African village, are the American high school hallway. Although a wide range of personality types are present in Europeans, on the whole, our people are quieter, more restrained, more under self-control. The difference between races can be seen in everything from the intricate musical melodies of Mozart compared to the elemental beat of rap, from quiet fashion to flashy dress, from thoughtful and considerate speech to the loud and boisterous nature that Cockman admired in his study of the black personality. In the cold North, as the European was more restrained and less aggressive, so the European had to develop an intense sense of community and social justice. In an African tribe of gatherers, everyone can provision himself. He can eat and indulge himself while others gather, and no one will be the wiser. He has less vital need to share or develop higher systems of social justice or common welfare. In the small hunting bands of Europe, sometimes game was so scarce that an individual hunter might not bring home any game for weeks, but one hunter's reindeer could fend off starvation for the whole group. Pressures for community needs and a group altruism must have been intense, creating the social conscience and the ethics of ultimately what became the European people and the Asian people. Successfully hunting the great mastodons of Europe took a tremendous group effort. Bringing down one took planning, coordination, and effective and precise communication. There was a high risk of death. Under such circumstances, the gene pool would favor genes of altruism and self-sacrifice, for each hunter had to take great individual risks so that the clan could survive. After the kill, there had to be a well-organized effort and division of labor to process and preserve its valuable resources. Fire became vital for survival. In inclement conditions, it is much easier to keep a fire going than to light one. Some ancient bands likely lit a fire when it was warm and dry in the fall and then endeavored to keep it going all winter. To do that took teamwork, responsibility, accountability, emotional restraint, and self-discipline. If just one member of the group who had responsibility for keeping the fire going failed for reasons of stupidity or irresponsibility, the whole group could die. One could imagine the punishment. This is a side note in my audio version. One could imagine the punishment of that person who let the fire go out, maybe even death, because it could cost the tribe its life, the life of every member of the tribe. So these traits found the genetic component in further generations of those who lived and died because of those traits. If the exhausted hunter did not rise when it was his watch, delay his immediate need for the gratification of sleep and willfully stay awake to tend the fire, many could die. I believe that these were some of the evolutionary forces that forged the Europeans' intelligence, self-control, altruism, and sense of social justice. Our government forms, our principles of self-government and freedom, as well as our social conscience. In a hunting society where birth rates are low and death rates are high, both the female and the male must protect, provision, and treasure each child. In Africa, where men were driven more by sexual coupling than by love of family, and where the most honored are those with the greatest number of sexual conquests, an individual child or its mother meant little to those males who had many sexual partners and large numbers of children. When human life is too abundant, it tends to lose value. And by the way, as a side note for my audiobook, won't we see this in so many European cities where we have presences of large numbers of African and American cities? We see the same pattern evolving of women who are used sexually, impregnated, and abandoned. And this is a common moor in the ghetto of almost every Western European city, both in Europe and the United States. On the other hand, in a small, struggling band that faces the severest challenges of survival, each life becomes precious. And its rarity gives it and gives the people an appreciation of life's beauty. Our ancestors had that appreciation. A man who has many sexual partners is not as selective about his mate as one who must choose for a lifetime. And in the hard times and the hard climbs, women and their families had to select men for their loyalty and responsibility. So evolved our race, and so arose the nuclear family. Now, here's a long list showing a partial survey of the racial differences today that were produced by the differences of the cold European East Asian climate and that of more tropical Africa. Again, you can find these charts in my book. We'll first talk about some of the conditions and some of the necessities, and then we'll talk about the traits. We have two different charts here from my book, which you can refer to again in the hard copy. On the left are the first column, I'm going to give you the prehistoric European and East Asian conditions, and on the right, prehistoric sub-Saharan Africa. Okay, this is the European conditions first. Complex, sturdy shelter, critical for survival, obviously. Winter, extremely harsh climate. Warm, well-made clothing, critical. Ability to make and control fire, critical. Long periods of resource deprivation. Periods of little vegetation, a few small animals or birds, hunting necessary, foresight, planning, and delayed gratification necessary for survival. Resource scarce, male provisioned hunting society, monogamy, favored. Male provisioned society, less sexual and physical aggression, favored. And promiscuous behavior resulting in fights often lead to death of a mate and children. So in prehistoric European and East Asian conditions, that tends to be on a smaller scale than a non-harsh climate. Now we'll go to the conditions of prehistoric sub-Saharan Africa. Minimal shelter needed for survival. The temperature never even gets cold enough to freeze. No winter, comfortable climate. No clothing required for survival. Fire not required for survival. Resources far more abundant. Food gathering less problematic in tropical climes. And also little seasonal change, so immediate gratification is more favored. Female provision society, rather than male provision society, favors male aggression and sexual drive, and death and fights from sexual competition are not critical for the survival of mates and children. Now we'll go to the chart, and this is a long chart. I'll try to deal with it, and it's kind of interesting. I'll go from Africans to Europeans and East Asians. Okay, physical traits first. Darker skin is for Africans. Europeans and Asians, lighter skin. Africans, black hair, dark eyes. Europeans and East Asians, some with lighter eyes and hair. Africans, kinky hair. Europeans, thinner hair, straight and curly variety. Africans, musculature favors speed. Europeans, musculature favors strength. Africans, less body fat and smaller body cavity. Europeans, more body fat and larger body cavity. Africans, wide flat nose for quick intake of air. Europeans, longer nose for warming cold air. Africans, longer arms in relationship to body height. Europeans, shoulder arms in relation to body height. Africans, higher testosterone level among males. Europeans, lower testosterone level among males. Brain differences. Africans, smaller cranium. Europeans, larger cranium. Smaller brain autopsy data. Larger and heavier brain autopsy data. Smaller brain by endocranial volume. Larger brain by endocranial volume data. Smaller brain by external head measures. Larger brain by external head measures. Okay, Africans, thicker cranium, lower facial angle. Europeans, thinner cranium, steeper facial angle. Africans, less frontal lobe area, cerebral cortex. Europeans, more frontal lobe area and cerebral cortex. And these apply, most of them, to both Europeans and Asians. Africans, brain less convoluted, sulcated. And Europeans, brain more convoluted, fissurated. Africans, larger dentition, more prognathic jaw. Europeans and East Asians, smaller dentition, less prognathic jaw. Intelligence, IQ tests, lower on the Africans, higher among Europeans. Decision time, slower among Africans, higher in Europeans. Cultural achievements, few among Africans, abundant among Europeans. Mentally gifted, extremely rare among Africans. Mentally gifted, much more common among Europeans. Mental retardation, more common among Africans. Mental retardation, much less common among Europeans. Mental health problems, more common among Africans. Mental health problems, less common among Europeans. Reproductive traits. Two-egg twinning higher among Africans. Two-egg twinning one-half as frequent among Europeans. Hormone levels higher. Hormone levels lower among Europeans. African secondary sexual features pronounced. European secondary sexual features less pronounced. Intercourse frequencies higher among Africans. Intercourse frequencies lower among Europeans. Permissive attitudes higher among Africans. Permissive attitudes lower among Europeans. Sexually transmitted diseases higher, much higher among Africans. Sexually transmitted diseases much lower among Europeans. Personality, aggressiveness higher among Africans. Among Europeans, lower. Impulsivity, higher among Africans. Lower among Europeans. Sociability, higher among Africans. Sociability, lower among Europeans. Dominance, higher among Africans. Dominance, lower among Europeans. Activity level, higher among Africans. Activity level, lower among Europeans. Cautiousness lower among Africans, cautiousness higher among Europeans, obviously with that rough environment, and less delay of gratification among Africans, more delay of gratification among Europeans. Social patterns. Illegitimacy much higher among Africans, lower among Europeans. Polygamy much higher among Europeans, much lower. Criminality much higher among Europeans, much lower. Marriage stability lower. And Africans among Europeans, much higher. Gestation period shorter. Maturation rates among Africans, longer among Europeans. Skeletal development earlier among Africans, later among Europeans. Motor development earlier among Africans, motor development later among Europeans. Dental development earlier among Africans, later among Europeans. The age of first intercourse earlier among Africans. Age of first intercourse later among Europeans. Age of first pregnancy earlier among Africans. Age of first pregnancy later. And lifespan shorter among Africans. Lifespan longer among Europeans. Now, all these traits I just went over in these charts, and I would really suggest the book because you can see these in their juxtaposition. All these traits exist throughout the globe, within societies, and between different nations, and they exist in present times and in past times. These things generally are constant. This doesn't mean every African has this characteristic or every European has this characteristic, but as a group, these different characteristics absolutely exist and can be documented. And in fact, I again suggest the above cited works of J. Philippe Brushton, and you can get those that information for those books from my website, davidduke.com. So, my friends, the races evolved quite differently. Those differences can be seen in the racial boundaries of the modern world and in the nature of the societies that thrive in them. The European race evolved into a people who have dived to the bottom of the ocean, soared through the air and into space, looked into the cell and the atom, put his footprints on the moon, and unlocked the secrets of our very genome. The unique genotype that the cold climes of Europe fashioned has enabled European mankind to do all that it's done. And its understanding and this aspect of genetic history is the key to all that he has yet to do. Now in this audio tape, as well as my book, I want to begin to cover the moral religious battle. Of course, I've outlined the raw, clear, abundant, massive scientific evidence of incredibly deep and intrinsic differences that exist between races. We need to talk about the moral religious battle involved in these things. And is it, you know, the fact that race differences exist? What is our moral position about this and how to react to this? So we'll go into that now. After I had a rudimentary understanding of the underlying concepts of the evolution of life, and during the time I was just becoming racially aware, I attended Clifton Gaines Junior High, a private school in New Orleans run by the Church of Christ. They taught an anti-evolutionary creationist doctrine. Even though there were numerous competing theories of evolution, I certainly believe that all life on Earth had evolved and is still undergoing change. As a devout Christian and a science-minded geologist, my father had the opinion that the idea of an evolutionary basis for higher life was not antagonistic to the belief in God. He simply looked at nature as the tools of God's creation. When I was young enough, he quoted me the first stanza of the William Henry Carruth poem, "Each in His Own Tongue." And I still know the poem by heart today. It goes like this. A fire mist and a planet, a crystal and a cell, a jellyfish and a saurian in caves where cavemen dwell. Then a sense of law and beauty, and a face turned from the clod. Some call it evolution, and others call it God. In my Bible classes at my fundamentalist school, I learned the details of the creationist belief that God instantly created mankind and all nature. At that time, most fundamentalist Christians never denied that God in his creation established the distinctions between the different races. In fact, most of the main Christian denominations were segregated until the 1960s. That is 1,960 years before it was discovered that the church and Jesus had it all wrong all this time, and that somehow it was not Christian to recognize racial differences and respect them. As the years passed, egalitarianism became the dogma of our times. Not only did many of the evolutionary anthropologists become egalitarians, but so did many creationists. Today, a common attitude among creationists is that God made us all the same. In reality, though, the creationist viewpoint shows God is the architect of race. For if one maintains that God made nature and humanity as it is, then it must be conceded that he created the distinct races, gave them different features, behavioral tendencies, and mental abilities. We know these exist. Furthermore, he segregated them from one another on different continents. From a thoughtful creationist point of view, to deny the reality of race and racial difference is really a denial of God's own handiwork. Interestingly, from the creationist point of view and the biblical point of view and the Christian point of view, the reality of race is also reinforced by the Holy Bible. If the creationist uses the Old Testament as his guide to the creation and as his guide to God's view of race, it is quickly apparent that the Old Testament is in fact a testament of race. It is a history of one people, the Israelites, in continuous conflict with the differing racial groups of the Middle East region. It emphasizes their own genealogy and the repeated commands by God not to mix their seed, which is really an equivalent of the scientific concept of genes, with other breeds or races or groups or tribes. I have much more on this in the Race and Christianity chapter, but whether one takes the evolutionary or creationist viewpoint, both support the reality of race. I found it amazing to see how the mass media was able to convert both the scientific community, which espoused evolution, and the fundamentally opposed creationist community into spouting almost an identical egalitarian dogma. Their victory was complete by the time I graduated from high school. The intellectual secular community branded anyone who dared to publicly promote the idea of racial differences as unscientific. Anyone in the religious community who dared to tell the truth of race was accused of being against the Bible and God himself. Egalitarianism had become a de facto religion, incorporated under both the name of science and religion. Simple recognition of racial differences became a moral sin equivalent to adultery or perhaps even murder. But the racial heretics have not gone away quietly. And with each passing day, more evidence emerges of the dramatic, genetically born physical and psychological differences between the races. And the same thing is true of the differences between the sexes. Today, the idea of ingrained psychological, brain-oriented differences between men and women has become widely accepted among society. And you'll see more of that in my Sex Differences chapter later in the book. Tomorrow, I think the same will become true of race. The next section is the evolutionary ladder. As I began to understand the evolutionary differences between the races, a question naturally arose. Do the European and East Asian races represent a higher level of human evolution than the African race? Now, such questions are fraught with difficulty, for subjective judgments of what is advanced and what is primitive will determine many assessments of race and evolution. But if one endeavors to be as objective as possible, a broad outline can emerge. Let us again suppose that we put ourselves into the shoes of extraterrestrials here to study life on Earth from a galaxy far, far away. Just as we classify the phylum, order, species, and races, subspecies of nature, so we would include mankind in that classification structure. We would note the hard evidence of the great age of the Earth, such as the eras of geologic time it took to raise Mount Everest from the bottom of the sea and make it the highest point on the planet Earth. We know that rock in the highest reaches of Mount Everest was once seabed because of the fossils of sea life embedded deep in it. We also could look at the genetic links of all living things through DNA, chromosomes, and genes. We would notice that the fossil record indicates that in the oldest geologic strata, one finds the most primitive organisms, and the most complex and intelligent life forms are found in the most recent geologic strata. One also could not help but notice that the closest relatives to man are the recent primates, who are relatively close in DNA. Chimpanzees, for instance, share 98.5% of DNA with people. Among the primates, we'd also note that the lower primates, such as the lemurs, are less intelligent and have smaller craniums than the higher primates, such as the chimpanzees, apes, and humans. Lemurs have longer muzzles and such prognathous and cranial musculature to support it leaves a smaller brain per body weight. Another difference is that lower evolutionary species have considerably faster maturation rates and reproductive rates than higher primates. In the same way, we could classify the higher primates on a higher evolutionary plane than lower primates, we could certainly rank the lower primates on a higher plane than most other mammals and reptiles, and in turn, reptiles above insects. Indeed, the life forms of the planet Earth represent many stages of the evolution from the simplest amino acids to one-celled plants and animals, ultimately to mankind himself. Indeed, the life forms of the planet Earth represent many stages of the evolution from the simplest amino acids to one-celled plants and animals, and ultimately to mankind itself. Among the races of mankind, these extraterrestrial scientists would certainly classify the larger-brained Europeans and East Asians as the most evolutionary advanced. We could look at man's evolution somewhat like the evolution of the modern automobile. There has been improvement since the days of the human-pulled, wooden-wheeled cart or horse-drawn chariot to the computer-programmed modern automobile. Of course, the evolution of man from his primitive to his modern state came from nature, or as some might put it, God acting through nature. When we look at the anthropological evidence of man's development from the primitive to the Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and Homo sapiens levels, it's easy to see the evolutionary development is gauged by the brain size and accompanying technological achievement that goes along with that size. If the gradations in the brain size from the small-brained Australopithecus to the large-brained human are important, should we now believe that differences in brain size have no corresponding importance to the different races of humanity? I think it would be safe to say that our hypothetical extraterrestrial visitors would find that Europeans and Asians are higher than Africans on the evolutionary scale. In a moment, I'm going to discuss ideas like superiority or inferiority, which I think are really different questions, but for now, we can leave it there. I also wondered how the white and Asian races compared on the evolutionary scale. There has been evidence in recent years showing that Northeast Asians, such as Japanese and Chinese, might exceed the Europeans in some capacities, in spite of greater cultural and language barriers than indigenous blacks. They have shown many educational and socioeconomic successes in Western nations. Many studies put their average IQ as an equal or even slightly superior to the performance of Europeans. Their high average IQ has certainly shown them capable of maintaining highly organized and efficient civilizations, and they have done so. Now, I do not find it demeaning to my race, a European race, to acknowledge the high average IQ of the Asian race. Both races are certainly high on the ladder of evolution. There is some evidence, however, that some genetic factors cause Europeans to produce more of the highest creative achievements. Although the Asians have a slightly higher IQ, their population IQ distribution appears to be more tightly bunched around the average. They have fewer extremely low IQ individuals and fewer with extremely high IQs. This makes for a very competent and stable workforce. Europeans, by contrast, have a much more widely dispersed IQ. In other words, we have far more geniuses per capita than Asians do. But it must also be noted that we unfortunately have far more imbeciles. Of course, the fact that we have far more geniuses does us no good at all if they're outvoted by the greater numbers of those with extremely low intelligence. It's no advantage to us if we force a leveling equality on our schools and don't have adequate programs to develop the latent talents of the profound geniuses among us. Interestingly enough, even though Europeans are outnumbered by huge Asian populations, we far excel them in seminal scientific achievements. And this is true even as we approach the end of the 20th century and the beginning years of the 21st century. The old adage that the Oriental may not have invented radio and television, but he can sure make television sets a lot faster, cheaper, and more efficiently, seems to have some basis in reality. There are, of course, many Asians of great mental ability, and time itself will be the ultimate arbiter of evolutionary fitness. Right now, the Asians seem to be far less susceptible to the egalitarian propaganda that's infected the West, and there is little threat to their genetic heritage in their own homelands, unlike that as exists in Europe and the Americas. There's 1.3 billion Chinese, and they're in a country that's essentially all Chinese, with no massive integration or massive multiracialism or massive non-Chinese immigration. Both the Japanese and Chinese have seem to develop certain social and governmental policies that have a genetic or eugenic influence, in effect, as well as educational programs designed to educate all of their IQ groups to the best of their abilities. Whatever their qualities, and they are considerable, the Asians are still quite different from Europeans, and their distinct genetic pattern will express itself in both their unique physical appearance and their psychological and cultural character. Europeans can look with respect on them as we hope they look on us the same way. There is no question that many Asians as individuals can fit productively into Western nations. Our nations can perhaps even assimilate limited numbers in our gene pool without a dramatic effect on our own characteristics. Such has certainly happened in historical Eastern Europe. But if the great waves of non-European immigration continue in the West, we will lose our evolutionary and characteristic distinctiveness. And this would be a tragic occurrence for both us and for all peoples of the earth. Our distinctive racial character has been responsible for the vast majority of the greatest scientific and artistic creations of Western civilization. The civilization which could accurately be described as becoming in the last century a world civilization, as many of its technological, artistic, and political tenets have come to dominate. Those contributions have brightened the lives of the intelligent and creative of all races throughout the world. There is no guarantee that any other race can continue that record of excellence, and that can only be answered by time. Aside from considerations of evolutionary fitness, it is natural for all races to prefer the company and aesthetics of their own race. I love the look and the spirit of my people in our fair-skinned, light-featured, aesthetic countenance. We find our own concept of beauty. Whether it's embodied in the Norse-like god and Adam of the Sistine Chapel, or in the perennial blonde angel-like prototype of beauty revered the world over, our race needs no justification to seek its own survival. And for that matter, no race needs justification for its own survival. The way that evolutionary fitness is ultimately decided is in evolutionary success. At present, our people seem hell-bent on allowing their genotype to be extinguished from the planet, even from our own homelands. Here's how the Random House Webster's Dictionary defines three important terms. Genotype. Noun, genetics. The genetic makeup of an organism or group of organisms with reference to a single trait, set of traits, or entire complex of traits. Two, the sum total of genes transmitted from parent to offspring. Phenotype. genotype. Genocide, the deliberate and systematic extermination of a national, racial, political, or cultural group. Race suicide, the extinction of a race or people that tends to result when, through the forbearance of its members to have children, the birth rate falls below the death rate. Unquote. Race suicide could also be hastened when a race allows a massive immigration of an alien race into its society and the loss of genetic survival through massive racial intermixture. In promoting the idea of my own racial survival, I understand that all races share the same goal. If I were an African, I doubt that I would care about evolutionary gradations and where my people would rank in the charts. I'd love my own and everything that is unique about my own society. An African can only be inferior in things that he is not good at, and he can always be superior in what he is born to do. If the destiny of the black race is to live closer to the natural world, so be it. Whatever fate he seeks, it would be a destiny he must decide for himself and mold by his own hands in the same way that we create our own destiny. The next section is from Fears of Extinction to Dreams of the Stars. Once I grasped the idea that our race was vital to the evolutionary progress of mankind, a whole new perspective dawned on me. The appreciation of ecology that I gained as a very young man in the swamps and forests and wetlands of South Louisiana now helped me to fully understand how mankind is an integral part of that ecology. Understanding race is simply an understanding of what Garrett Hardin calls, quote, human ecology. It is not immoral to recognize the realities of race. In fact, there is no higher morality than to work for the survival of your own kind. It is not immoral for our people to defend themselves. Is it not ridiculous for some of our people to work hard to preserve the unique breeds of whales around the world while they denounce those who seek the preservation of the unique breeds of humanity, including their own? Furthermore, are not the high moral qualities that inspire some egalitarians, in fact, created by the same race that they are so intent on dissolving into some sort of interracial soup? The high morals that they tout come from the highest ideals of civilization and culture, ideals created fundamentally by the European people. Breeders of thoroughbred horse races would be horrified to see the lines so carefully matched for speed over centuries randomly interbred out of existence with horses that could only run half as fast. Imagine for a moment if only one pair of thoroughbreds were left on Earth. Wouldn't people do everything they could to preserve that magnificent breed of horse? Our people have been the thoroughbreds of civilization. Should we not preserve our genetic distinctiveness, the unique heritage that has produced so much beauty on the earth? Another thought in the audio version of this book, where I diverge from my text here, imagine for a second the panda, which is a very endangered species of animal, our breed of bear, actually. And imagine the outcry, and they're trying to increase the panda population. Imagine if the outcry that would exist if zooners just randomly started mixing pandas with other kinds of breeds of bear that exist in the hundreds of thousands on the planet. You know, wouldn't there be a tremendous anger and outcry from the people who want to preserve this unique expression of life? Well, doesn't the same thing apply to our unique expression of humanity? Don't we have a right to preserve ourselves as well? I go on with the text. The opponents of racial awareness constantly parrot the idea that it's hateful and barbaric to be racially conscious. And for a white person, it is said to be downright evil to desire the preservation of our own racial integrity. But how morally supreme is a racially mixed black and brown world as compared to the European world? What areas of the globe have the most brutal crime, including rape, assault, robbery, and murder? Which races have more concern for human rights and justice? Which races more frequently have political freedom? And among which races is despotism more prevalent? Which have better medical care for the sick and afflicted and have more concern for them? Which have more opportunity and fairer treatment of women? Which race leads our adventures into space? Where is the compelling evidence that the demise of the white race is really going to produce more humanitarianism, more love, more brotherhood, and all the catchwords of the egalitarians? Do 6,000 murders a year in racially amorphous Rio de Janeiro somehow represent a moral example to the rare murders in the more racially homogeneous Tokyo, Japan, or Stockholm, Sweden? The racial equalitarian arguments remind me of how I learned the communists promised freedom and equality to the Russians and other Eastern Europeans, but instead murdered tens of millions and created great slave nations. I came to believe by the tender age of 15 that if I truly wanted a society capable of the love and decency that the egalitarians so seemed to value, that I had to preserve my genotype. It also became apparent that our people's right to preserve our heritage and freedom is the most basic right of all. The right we have, and the right we defend, and the right I defend in this book and in my life, is really the right to live, the right of our people to live. Ever since I was a small boy, I have heard the media claim that the most terrible act of the 20th century was the attempted destruction of the Jewish people during the Second World War. Any attempt to wipe out a race should be an execrable crime in anyone's mind. In fact, commentators said that what made the atrocities against Jews so terrible was not the murder of such great numbers per se, because there had been bigger slaughters in Russia and China, but because the fact that this was an alleged attempt to wipe out the Jewish people. Yet, why is not the eventual destruction of our European genotype, the genocide of our race, any less terrible than that which is claimed to have been attempted against Jews? The ultimate result is the same. As I recognized the genetic crisis we faced, I also became inspired with the possibilities for our people of understanding race and understanding evolution. If the genetic improvement of our race created by the Ice Ages produced such great achievements, then nurturing our genetic quality offered great hope for the future. The environmentalists, whether they be capitalists or communists, Democrats or totalitarians, say that the way to a better world is through the better mechanisms of society, government or lack of it. In fact, all of man's history has been about man's progress through the tools he created. The crucible of the Ice Ages created a genetically brilliant people who, starting with no written language, no schools, no domesticated animals, no complex architecture, created eventually these things from nothing. Nothing from nothing but their intelligence and their innate abilities. If the behavioral environmentalists were right, prehistoric man could never have built the first civilization, for his environment was far too primitive and uneducated and ignorant to ultimately have created civilization from nothing. But the truth is that our heritage ultimately created civilization from nothing but the priceless genetic heritage carried inside of them. The Ice Ages and the effects of nature and evolution created intelligence to such a point, such a high point, and ability to such a point that our people could eventually create language and culture and writing and architecture and education from nothing. Basically from nothing. The achievements of European people can be contrasted to the centuries of the African races' inability to even copy successfully what Europeans originated. The great treasure our people possessed has always been in our genes, rather than in our gold and gadgets. As a side note for the audio, I remember a classic tape, liberals always use a classic song, and it's called Billy Jack. It says, "Listen, children, to a story that was written long ago about a people on a mountain and the valley folk below. And the valley folk were jealous of the mountain people. And they said, why do you have such a wonderful society? You must have stores of gold. We must, you know, attack the castle and get the gold. But when they finally did it and slaughtered the mountain people, they didn't find any gold. You know, they found even just a slab underneath. Peace on earth is all it said. It was the quality of the people that made the mountain people the way they were. And that's true, I think, in terms of our people. And the idea that somehow if we get rid of European mankind that we're going to improve life for the people of the world, I think that's a complete – first of all, I think it's an evil position, and I think it's completely untrue because our people have given so many gifts to this planet and so many areas of humanity and life and culture and beauty. While still in high school, I read Elmer Pindell's classic book, Sex versus Civilization. I think he could have chosen a better title. Anyway, Pindell was a population expert who had written many books on the perils of overpopulation. He pointed out that one couldn't properly deal with human quantity, that problem, without addressing the human quality issue. He also made clear the strange interaction of human evolution with civilization, which I call the Great Paradox. He said that the Ice Ages produced the most magnificent intellectual powers of what we call modern or Cro-Magnon man, the prototype of the modern European. As the Ice Ages receded and the climate became less harsh, those genetically accumulated abilities flowered in the world's first great civilizations. Over time, intellect combined with accumulated learning brought on the highest cultural and technological achievements. Ironically, at the same time civilization makes achievements, it begins to foster a dysgenic selection that in many ways is opposite to the eugenic effect of the prehistoric period that led to the development of the qualities that created the civilization to begin with. The same sharing and social justice principles that helped the small hunting bands of high quality to survive, applied indiscriminately to a larger society, leads to degeneration. The least intelligent and fit reproduce faster than the best. Problem makers reproduce faster than problem solvers. As the most intelligent found their pleasure in their business, religious, or governmental activities, as well as the arts or the various pleasures that could be purchased with affluence, they had smaller families. The least intelligent continued to find their greatest pleasures in the sexual acts that also increased their numbers. The organization of civilization also meant a change in the conduct of wars. In most primitive societies, warfare could wipe away the whole gene pool and replace it with more intelligent and efficient groups. Civilization's wars tended to leave the physical and mental defectives at home while impressing the healthiest and fittest, who by virtue of their youth had often not even yet had children. Through a succession of wars, the best and bravest traditionally led the troops and suffered the highest casualties, while the more cowardly or timid stayed behind and had a greater likelihood of surviving. As civilizations increased in power and ranged in conquest far beyond the original boundaries of the people who built them, they sometimes brought back slaves from among the conquered peoples, such as the Egyptian transport of Nubians into the heart of Egypt. Often the genes of those non-civilized populations were slowly absorbed into the conqueror's gene pool. So for generations, sometimes even centuries, the accumulation of wealth and knowledge led to advances in civilization. But while the advances were continuing, under the surface, with dysgenics, the genetic foundation of the civilization was gradually undermined until at last, usually more rapidly than it arose, civilization collapsed, and their societies were weakened and conquered by more vigorous peoples. The genetically weakened subjects became destined to live in the ruins of past achievement. So the great paradox of man is that though the harshness of nature over the eons had developed his genetic capacity for civilization, that the institutions then and the processes of civilization he created begins to reverse the evolutionary process, weaken him genetically, and eventually cast him back into barbarity. At first, learning about the cyclic fate of civilization, it can be quite discouraging, but when one thoroughly understands the process that has repeatedly occurred, one sees the opportunity to learn from it. I realize that the answers to the great challenges of mankind lay not in the tools or creations of our race, but in the quality of our race itself. If our people continue up the evolutionary ladder, we will become smarter, healthier, and cross genetic thresholds that will someday make going to the moon seem as simple as a child's walk across the living room. Instead of focusing on bettering the achievements of man, when we focus on bettering mankind itself, the next galaxy may someday seem as close to us as a neighboring city in our current era. The unleashed power of the genes will one day pass through any barrier, even the seemingly unsurmountable obstacle of the speed of light. For I believe that if we're advanced enough, we can solve any problem. I believe that the universe is constructed so that anything is possible. Consider the great achievements that mankind's achieved with its present IQ range. It has sent probes to the stars and fixed errant genes. We cannot begin to comprehend what our people could do in the distant future with an IQ equivalent to our present one cubed. The principle of race for me went beyond even the survival of my heritage and all the things I loved in our civilization. It became the key to the stars. I now understood that preserving my own race and its civilization was but a precondition for continuing its evolution to a higher level. As Nietzsche so eloquently advocated, man must go beyond man. It seemed to me that our race's struggle is similar to that of a man who made a long, hard climb up a high mountain. He has one more ledge to climb, and then the whole world and sky will be laid out before him. He grasps the utmost crag and proceeds to pull himself up. But down around his ankles are those lesser ones who keep pulling him back toward the abyss. We are that climber. We have probed the bottom of the ocean and walked on the moon. We have unlocked the secrets of flight, cured the incurable, and discovered many of the secrets of life itself. We have even begun the first feeble movements toward understanding and helping to direct our own higher evolution. We can even affect the genes themselves with our modern science. The future awaits, heroic and magnificent, shining as beautifully as the brightest stars on a clear night. Our fingernails are clinging to that summit, bathed in light, while the genetic forces of regression pull us down from below. Either we shall recognize racial realities and the powers within our genes and climb up toward a new era, or we shall tumble into the abyss, never to rise again. As a teenager, when I came to understand these things, on cloudless nights I would stare up at the Milky Way, no longer like a viewer of a great cosmic portrait. I was part of that artwork. My genes and even my atoms were part of the planet Earth and all of its life forms, and indeed part of the cosmos. I found meaning in my life by helping as best I could the still primitive embryo of mankind and my people to grow to adulthood on earth and in the heavens. No matter how slight my contribution might be, I wanted to help form a community of my kind who shared the same vision. And that vision, the continued higher evolution of mankind to the next evolutionary step toward the stars. At 16, I knew that I had to stand on the side of evolutionary advancement and not on the side of degeneration and barbarism. The next chapter is a very fascinating chapter. It's called Race History. And I start with a quotation by Benjamin Disraeli. The racial question is the key to world history. All is race. There is no other truth. And this begins to bring the scientific principles I've been discussing into the reality of existence, into the reality of history. And you can see these principles at work in an historical and contemporary context. I think you'll enjoy it. The next chapter is chapter 10, Race History.